Brian Nagy. Welcome to another edition of Feldenkrais Podcasts. Today we have part two of our interview with Alan Questel, where we talk about creativity and embodying the creative process. Can creativity be taught with the Feldenkrais Method? Alan believes that it can, and makes the assertion that a Feldenkrais Awareness Through Movement lesson parallels the creative process by generating an embodied sense of creativity and new choices. Later in the interview, Alan also speaks to the role of context in awareness through movement lessons. I'm Ryan Nagy, and I hope you enjoy part two of my interview with Alan Questel.
One of the places my curiosity resides a lot is in the idea of creativity.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. You've got some, I think you've got a half a dozen CD sets out there.
There's one on creativity. It's called Creating Creativity, Embodying the Creative Process, and there's five others that are on different themes.
Okay, so let's talk about the ones on creativity for a moment. What is creativity to you? Dare I say, how do you define creativity, or will you shoot me if
I say that? You can't, that's what we try to do with things, is define them, and actually, the workshop that I taught actually comes out of a book I wrote called Creating Creativity, Embodying the Creative Process, which I'm still in the process of trying to get published. I did find an agent, and I'm working on that. But when I wrote about it, it was initially a book about acting in Feldenkrais.
Mm-hmm.
And I started out by trying to define creativity, which I pretty quickly found was antithetical to the idea of creativity, because it's not something finite. It's a process, and it's dynamic. And so then I started to explore different concepts that exist in the realm of the creative process, and then I looked for movement experiences that led people to have an embodied sense of it, an experience of it, rather than just a cognitive understanding of it.
Mm-hmm. And so you can't define it, but you are teaching it, so there must be some structure to it, some process of creativity.
Well, I mean, look, if you look at an ATM lesson, an ATM lesson itself parallels creativity. As a matter of fact, where the idea first came from was in the second year of my training in Amherst when Moshe was yelling at Jack Heggie.
Uh-huh.
I remember sitting up and thinking, this guy's teaching creativity. And of course, my next thought was, the audacity. How could you teach 220 people creativity? And, of course, that was something I later embarked on, and I think it actually is possible to teach it. But look, if I ask a group of people, are you creative? What happens is there's some people whose hands shoot right up, and there's others who their hand slowly comes up, and then unfortunately there's a bunch that look to the floor
mm-hmm.
and start to get depressed.
Right.
Okay, so I'll ask a different question. Do you know someone who's creative or more creative than you? And everybody raises their hand, without exception. And I'll ask the question, what's different between you and them? And the difference, the only difference that I've come up with someone who's more creative is that they see choices that I haven't seen. So someone might take a Chinese parasol and actually hang it upside down and make it into a light fixture. And I'll come into their house and go, wow, that's beautiful. I never would have thought of that. And that's generally our experience. So an ATM is actually something that generates choice, right? That's one of the things behind them.
Mm-hmm.
So I can do things in a variety of ways. But there's something also inherent in an ATM that's fascinating in terms of creativity, in that really to be in the creative process, you don't know where you're going to end up. So, for example, when I was an actor, I would get a role, and I would have an idea about how this character would be played, and then I would try to leap towards it and jump towards this image that I held with it, which actually never worked. And as I trained as an actor, I started to understand the processes I could go through that would develop me and move me in different directions, and I'd actually end up at the same level as what I imagined, but it was never what I imagined.
Can you concretize that process a little bit more? So what were you doing differently the second time through?
I allowed myself to stay in the immediacy of what I was doing. I wasn't trying to jump ahead to where I thought I should be. Now, in ATM, that's really what it's about. You have to stay with the immediacy of the sensations through movement. So you can't jump ahead and feel what you're going to feel in a few minutes. Right? And now an ATM has a strong structure to it that guides us to it, but in the creative process, it's a little more amorphous, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's many things about it that that are not so clear? How do we find it? So I can give you a couple of examples of things that I would explore.
Sure.
One thing I noticed, for example, in actors, is that in any play, there's usually some high point, and then after that high point in the play, there's kind of a lull. There's a lull in the actor's interests and engagement. It produces a lull in the audience's engagement. And so I thought, well, what would be a movement experience that might provide someone a sense of continuity? So, you know, that was Moshe's, one of his claims to fame, and it's absolutely accurate, is that he could take abstract ideas and put them into a concrete experience.
Mm-hmm.
So something like this, I would have someone do a movement, let's say go from sitting to standing. And they go from sitting to standing, and I'd ask them to identify the beginning of the movement, the middle of the movement, and the end of the movement. Now, the beginning and the end is easy. Everything else is actually the middle, right? So
okay.
I then say, okay, so see if you can find the middle of the middle. Where would the place that be closest to the middle, and pause there? So make it a place that you could pause, that's not uncomfortable. And now start the movement from there, and now go to the end, except now that's the middle, and add something on. So they improvise a movement, which again isn't often what we do in ATM, but still there's a concept of being explored in this. So now they go from the middle of the first sequence to the end of it, which is now the middle, to a new movement. So there's a new beginning, a new middle, and a new end. And then we go to the middle of that, which is actually the end of the first process, and they go to the next movement they improvised, which is now the middle, and they add on something else. And we keep building this and adding on to it. And then by the end, I would have people go back to going from sitting to standing, and yet internally they feel compelled to continue because now I have a sense of continuity and movement that goes beyond what was considered the end.
Well, they would feel compelled to keep experimenting, to keep being creative?
They don't need to experiment. They've already created a whole series of sequences after that. So that their attention is actually carried beyond the end. Look, when I teach in training programs, one of the things I practice, especially at the end of a segment, sometimes it can be tricky to hold people in the room, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it can be tricky for the teacher, too, to think, oh, I'm flying home on Saturday, I've got all these things to do, and I can start to leave and take myself out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So what I actually do is I actually, you know, internally, I'm planning to teach on Monday. And I actually have material on my head that I could continue with so that I'm still in the middle of the process. I'm not energetically moving towards the end of something. I'm carrying it past where it might end, which allows people to remain in the room more fully as well because my attention is fully there, and it allows their attention to be more fully there as well.
Okay, now that makes perfect sense. That's similar to what you were doing with the, I hate to use the word, movement exploration.
I would call that one more of an ATM.
Uh-huh.
And again, if you look at Moshe's work, there's a wide range of how he approached things. You know, but one thing that's fairly consistent was he didn't produce a context in it. The movements were outside of the context. So I don't tell people what we're doing, right? I just say, let's start moving and see what happens.
And it seems to me you've talked about some other examples where you're specifically adding context in. So I believe you're talking about someone doing a movement like rolling over, and then
mm-hmm.
you change
yeah.
the... Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, I can. One thing before I say that, I've thought about this, and I've actually kind of looked for lessons where Moshe created a context, and I found one that's real clear, which is the lesson from Amherst that's called Praying Hands, so the prayer lesson, in which Moshe actually has you doing these movements with a sense of reverence, as if you were in a mosque or a synagogue or a church. And how does that affect the quality of the movement? And so that's a really interesting idea, but that's more unusual. The example you're talking about is one that I developed that looked at more of how context influences our movements and our emotions. So in that lesson, I'll have people just roll over on from the side onto the back, and I'll ask, what does it remind them of? And eventually someone will say, oh, it's like rolling over in bed. I said, great, now roll over in bed. Now that's different. It's different than just rolling over in an ATM
mm-hmm.
class. And I'll work with that a bit, and then I'll say, now roll over in bed as if you're going to turn off the alarm clock. And that changes everything, because people have very different relationships to the alarm clock, but most of us kind of, well, sluggishly or almost with some dread, better turn it off. And people's movements are usually heavy and tired, and, you know, they're pretending to slam a clock and stuff like this. And then I'll say, well, now pretend that you're turning off the alarm clock, you're rolling over to do it, except this time your clock is set 3 hours earlier than usual. And now, I mean, people can barely move.
Mm-hmm.
They're just like slugs, you know. And we'll do that for a while, and I'll say, now your alarm clock is set 3 hours earlier, but it's so you can go on a great vacation. And all of a sudden, people pop up. Right? They're almost standing by the time they turn off the alarm clock because the context has changed. The movement has changed as a result, and the emotional affect has changed as well. And we can go on from there. I can have them turn off the alarm clock so you can't wake your partner up. Right? And they'll do that, and they'll tiptoe around and do things and be very sensitive. And then I'll say, turn off the clock. You can't wake your partner, but you had a fight the night before. And that produces a whole series of different results because they're trying to be quiet and they can't wake their partner, but they want to because there's a fight that's unresolved. And then I ask the question, whose fault was the fight? And what I always find interesting is people have already made the choice. Either their fault or my fault, which says a lot about them, I think, in some ways. And then we play with those variations and different temperatures. And then at the very end, I'll have people just roll over. And the whole experience of rolling over outside of the context is now, I want to say, fleshed out. You know, or we could say boned out. Maybe it's more skeletal. But people have a whole different series of associations because that act has become differentiated in so many other ways than they initially thought of.
Hmm. And what's the context in which you're exploring context like this? Are we talking about the creativity workshop? Or
this would be in creativity, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you find yourself doing this in your trainings, say for teaching ATM or teaching someone how to be an ATM teacher? Or
no, not quite like that, no. I mean, I will, you know, as we get further along in the training, say, well, what concepts are being explored and how could the lesson be varied relative to a particular concept or what particular experience might we be looking to provide for someone? And the idea of making up an ATM, well, this is really complex because it's actually easier to make up an FI. The FI is for the individual who's under your hands, and mm-hmm. you can work with them and follow their needs and their habits and whatever movement is or isn't available to them. But an ATM has to be appreciable to a varied population. So it's much more challenging to create something like that. I find creating ATMs is probably the hardest thing I can think of doing relative to our work. Now, I want to go back for a second because I want to speak more about the idea of creativity in terms of what our work affords us. Most people, when they think of creativity, they have this a little unrealistic notion that it's a great, wonderful thing, which it is. But if you speak to people who are actually fully engaged in the creative process, whether it's a painter or a writer, an actor or a dancer, a musician, you'll see that they work very hard at it. And the moments of inspiration that leads to a new idea then has to be worked and tooled and practiced until their intention becomes actualized in some way, right? And often it's not actualized as they imagine. Actually, that was the definition, one of my definitions of creativity, which is to actualize what was previously unimaginable. But this is an emotional event, right? This struggle of working something. So then the question is, well, what is it that sustains us in the creative process? And I believe that the strongest thing that can sustain us is a sense of our skeleton, that it's the ground we can keep returning to, and a sense of self that we can rely on, that it's not being blown around in the winds of emotions, which can knock me over. And, you know, if I get knocked over, how do I get up? I need my bones to do it. And I had one woman in a workshop once, and this woman said, what about stories? And I said, what about them? And she said, well, in concentration camps, all people had were their stories, and they managed to sustain themselves through that process. And I went, wow, that's a pretty strong image. But, you know, if you think about the need for a story in that context, it was life or death. Most of us don't live in life or death. So if I have the story that I'm going to be the first person to do this and it's going to be great, well, I might feel inspired for a while, but then that feeling falls away, and the story that I'm going to tell myself about the first person to do da-da-da, it doesn't carry me anymore. I need something more immediate and more available to me than some story, because it's not a life or death situation.
I keep thinking of Moshe's need to be creative to overcome some of his injuries, something
Absolutely.
That kept moving him through, you know, helping him stick through the process.
And, of course, he had many I'm sure he had many times where he felt this is worthless. What am I doing? Look, he even talked about when he left physics and doing things like that in science, how he thought he became a quack. His mother even said to him, what are you doing? Playing with people's tuchuses, you know? But he knew that there was something intrinsically valuable in it, and he trusted that, and he stayed with it. But, you know, our work provides a sense of skeleton that exists in everything else, in all other domains, but never is it made as explicit as when we do it.
Yeah, or made conscious so that a person can work with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Probably should ask you, where can someone get a hold of these CDs? I believe, well, Seth at Easy Movement sells them. Do you sell them yourselves?
I sell them myself. You can get them from Movement Educators. You can get them from AchievingExcellence.com. You can get them from the Feldenkrais Guild, and a number of practitioners sell them as well. And as I said, there's six sets. One is called Falling.
Mm-hmm.
One is called The Moment Where We Begin, an exploration between intention and action.
Okay, and who is that for? Is that for the general public?
These are all workshops that are recorded in Switzerland each year. Actually, in English and Swiss Deutsch, and the Swiss Deutsch is pulled out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are public workshops. So they're for the public, they're for practitioners. I've had lots of practitioners buy them and say, can I teach it? And I go, yeah, teach it, absolutely. The next one is creating creativity, which is what we're talking about. Then there's one called The Pleasure of Challenge and The Challenge of Pleasure. There's a fifth one is Uncommon Sensing, Moving Beyond Your Self-Image. And the last one is called Reversibility.
Hmm.
And so they're all very different thematically, and they all have different lessons in them. And actually, I just recorded another one that's in the process of being edited now called Getting Hip, and it's about finding your hip joints.
Sweet. Well, I'll tell you what, I will put some links on the website for people that want to purchase those, and maybe in a future podcast or a future conversation, we can talk to some of these other questions I asked you about in the beginning. Maybe you can tell us some more about what's going on in the Feldenkrais training world out there.
I'd be happy to do so, and I want to thank you for you know, what you're providing the community and the public with what you're doing. I think it's great.
Yeah, you bet. It's a blast, and I think it's good that we can hear all these different voices, you know?
Yeah, good.
Cheers.